WBAI, WBAI.org on the web. Coming up next, what's going on with Rebecca Miles?
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. Punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
And welcome to What's Going On, the morning show on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. I'm the host, Rebecca Miles. We'll present a couple of local stories this morning and excerpts from the whistleblower testimony from Facebook before the Senate committee that happened at the Congress on Tuesday. Later in the show, and also later in the show, we'll have a guest, Dr. Eric North, Assistant Professor of Urban and Community Forests from the University of Minnesota, who, part of his team, has done some analysis on these tree planting programs we hear about. Certainly in New York, we've been the beneficiary of one of them. But how good are they really? Do they do what they purport to do? What does the analysis say? What have been the attempts that have already been made, and how have those fared 5 years from now? There's been an interesting study that comes out. We'll be talking about that later. And of course, this comes just before the COP26 happening in Glasgow, Scotland, at the end of this month and into November, where leaders from countries will gather for the Paris Agreement to try and solve the climate crisis under the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. That'll be later in the show. For the moment, though, we'll go to national news, and I'll be back with you after that. Thank you.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
These bills are not about left versus right, or moderate versus progressive, or anything that pits Americans against one another. These bills are about competitiveness versus complacency.
During a speech in Howell, Michigan, President Joe Biden laid out the case for passing his infrastructure and Build Back Better agenda, saying the bills are imperative to America's competitiveness in the world. Democrats were scheduled to vote on an infrastructure bill last week, but couldn't reach an agreement on a budget reconciliation package. Leaders have given themselves until the end of the month to reach a deal. Attorney General Merrick Garland has ordered federal law enforcement authorities to work with local officials in the coming weeks to address what the nation's top prosecutor called a disturbing spike in harassment, intimidation, and threats of violence against educators and school board members. Tennessee parent Justin Canoe described the heated environment of his 5-year-old daughter's school.
She went to school and was one of just a few kids in her class wearing a mask, which made her ask me why she had to. My answer was because we want to take care of other people.
The Justice Department says it will also unveil a series of additional measures to address the rise in criminal conduct directed toward school personnel. A former Facebook product manager told Congress on Tuesday that the company's platforms harm kids and stoke division. Frances Haugen urged lawmakers to take aggressive action to rein in the company.
There are organizational problems that need oversight And Facebook needs help in order to move forward to a more healthy place.
Arizona's Democratic Party has told Senator Kyrsten Sinema she could face a no-confidence vote. She's also been called an obstructionist by fellow state Dems. Arizonians frustrated with her holdout vote on Biden's spending plan recently confronted her over her stance in public at Arizona State University.
Will you support the Build Back Better plan so that we can have justice and solutions that we need for immigration, labor,
Build Back Better,
back the bill.
The Biden administration has reversed a ban on abortion referrals by family planning clinics, lifting a Trump-era restriction. The Department of Health and Human Services says its new regulation will restore the federal family planning program to the way it ran under the Obama administration, when clinics were able to refer women seeking abortions to a provider. Finally, Francis Collins, director of the National Institutes of Health, said Tuesday he will step down by the end of the year. Collins served three U.S. presidents as head of the institute for more than a decade. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our eight trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
And that was Nadia Ramlagan with some of the national news. And we'll have excerpts from the Facebook whistleblower testimony that was given to Congress on Tuesday later in the show. One of the local stories we're looking at is the controversial president of the police union, the Sergeants Benevolent Association, representing New York Police Department sergeants, resigned yesterday. This was at the request of the union's board, according to a letter it sent to its membership late Tuesday. On Monday, federal agents raided the offices of the New York City Police Union. Mullen had clashed with city officials over his incendiary tweets and hardline tactics. He'd been a supporter of Trump. They also raided his Long Island home on Monday. FBI spokesperson Martin Feely said agents searching the union's Manhattan headquarters were carrying out a law enforcement action in connection with an ongoing investigation. Mullins is also undergoing department disciplinary proceedings for tweeting NYPD paperwork last year regarding the arrest of Mayor Bill de Blasio's daughter during protests over George Floyd. Also, in April, the former Congresswoman from Arizona, Gabby Giffords, installed a memorial on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., with 40,000 flowers representing the number of Americans who died from gun violence each year. This week, she brought the gun violence memorial to Battery Park in New York City. Linda Perry reports.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Americans shouldn't have to pay for the consequences of Democrats' out-of-touch actions. Democrats are responsible for the spending. They need to take responsibility for the borrowing.
Republican West Virginia Congresswoman Carol Miller and other House lawmakers debate raising the U.S. debt ceiling. The House voted Wednesday on a bill that would suspend the ceiling, but it's doomed to fail in the Senate. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has told lawmakers the country will run out of money by mid-October. Progressive House lawmakers say they will oppose the $1 trillion infrastructure bill after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said she would seek a vote on the measure separately from Biden's $3.5 trillion social spending plan. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
Our objective here is winning two votes, getting these two pieces of important legislation across the finish line.
Democratic Senators Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin continue to oppose the $3.5 trillion package. The Senate Judiciary Committee examined a new Texas law banning abortions after 6 weeks and questioned the U.S. Supreme Court's use of its emergency or shadow docket to rule the law could stay in effect. Texas Democratic State Representative Donna Howard testified.
This has had a chilling effect on emergency room physicians, rural healthcare practitioners, and any medical professional who might be confronted with a post-6-week patient.
Meanwhile, a federal judge temporarily blocked a key aspect of a new Arizona abortion law hours before it was due to take effect. The law would have allowed felony charges to be brought against doctors who knowingly terminated pregnancies solely due to genetic abnormalities.
True or false? Telling your viewers that vaccines do not reduce risk of contracting illness can result in your channel receiving a strike or being terminated. The answer is true.
YouTube says it will ban the accounts of people who spread misinformation about vaccines. The company pointed specifically to videos that inaccurately describe what ingredients are used in vaccines, as well as allegations that vaccines can be used to track people who receive shots. The new mandate goes into effect immediately, and YouTube has already removed the pages of prominent anti-vaxxers, including Joseph Mercola and Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s Children's Health Defense Organization. The committee investigating the January 6th riot has released 11 new subpoenas, including seeking documents and testimony from Katrina Pearson, a spokesperson for Trump's 2016 campaign, and Maggie Mulvaney, a niece of former acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
And thank you again to Nadia Ramlagan for some more national news. Continuing on local news, and in New York City's vaccination mandate for school staff survived a court challenge. Meanwhile, hospitals across the state are reporting few disruptions in their services due to COVID-19 vaccine requirements for healthcare workers. U.S. District Judge Mary Kay Vasclokey in Manhattan rejected a request to temporarily block the vaccine mandate that New York City began enforcing on Monday for Department of Education employees. She said a lawsuit filed on behalf of several teachers and other school employees did not meet requirements for irreparable harm, likelihood of success, or public interest. And there's some good news for libraries. Officials announced that New York City's public libraries will no longer charge late fees and will waive existing fines for overdue books and other materials. Late fees had already been suspended since March 2020 because of the coronavirus pandemic. The new policy covers the New York Public Library, the Brooklyn Public Library, and the Queens Public Library. The three library systems join libraries in cities such as San Francisco, Chicago, and Philadelphia that no longer charge overdue fines. Officials say that more than half of New Yorkers whose library cards have been blocked for late fees live in high-need communities. And it's 7 o'clock and 12 minutes past the hour. This is Rebecca Miles in New York City. You're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. In other news, former Facebook manager Frances Hogan spoke on Capitol Hill yesterday.
My name is Frances Hogan. I used to work at Facebook. I joined Facebook because I think Facebook has the potential to bring out the best in us. But I'm here today because I believe Facebook's products harm children, stoke division, and weaken our democracy. The company's leadership knows how to make Facebook and Instagram safer, but won't make the necessary changes because they have put their astronomical profits before people. Congressional action is needed. They won't solve this crisis without your help. Yesterday, we saw Facebook get taken off the internet. I don't know why it went down, but I know that for more than 5 hours, Facebook wasn't used to deepen divides, destabilize democracies, and make young girls and women feel bad about their bodies. It also means that millions of small businesses weren't able to reach potential customers, and countless photos of new babies weren't joyously celebrated by family and friends around the world. I believe in the potential of Facebook. We can have social media we enjoy that connects us without tearing our democracy, putting our children in danger, and sowing ethnic violence around the world.
Hogan addressed a hearing of the Senate Commerce, Science and Transportation Subcommittee on Consumer Protection, Product Safety and Data Security. The whistleblower, who's a former Facebook data scientist, accused the company of pursuing profits over safety. She told Congress she believes stricter government oversight could alleviate the dangers that the company poses, from harming children to inciting political violence to fueling misinformation. Hogan's last role at Facebook was in counter-espionage. She was questioned by Republican Senator from Arkansas, Dan Sullivan.
Right now, is Facebook, I know Facebook is not allowed in countries like China, but do they provide platforms for authoritarian or terrorist-based leaders like the Ayatollahs in Iran? That's the largest state-sponsored terrorism in the world. Or the Taliban, or Xi Jinping, our biggest rival for this century, a communist party dictator who's trying to export his authoritarian model around the world. Do they provide a platform for those kind of leaders who, in my view, clearly don't hold America's interests in mind? Does Facebook provide that platform?
During my time working with the Threat Intelligence Org, so I was a product manager supporting the threat, the counter-espionage team. My team directly worked on tracking Chinese participation on the platform, surveilling, say, Uyghur populations in places around the world, that you could actually find the Chinese based on them doing these kinds of things.
So Facebook,
We also saw active participation of, say, the Iran government doing espionage on other state actors. So this is definitely a thing that is happening, and I believe Facebook's consistent understaffing of the counter-espionage, information operations, and counterterrorism teams is a national security issue, and I'm speaking to other parts of Congress about that.
So you are saying, in essence, that the platform, whether Facebook knows it or not, is being utilized by some of our adversaries in a way that helps push and promote their interests at the expense of America's?
Yes, Facebook's still very aware that this is happening on the platform. And I believe the fact that Congress doesn't get a report of exactly how many people are working on these things internally is unacceptable, because you have a right to keep the American people safe.
And that was Frances Hogan, who testified before the Senate committee in Congress yesterday. And you're listening to What's Going On at WBAI in New York. We've been just playing some of the excerpts from the Facebook whistleblower, Frances Hogan, who testified yesterday at the Senate hearing into the social network's role and practices. Hogan has accused her former employer of failing to make changes after internal research showed apparent harm to some teens. She was questioned by Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal.
As you may know, you do know, my office created an Instagram user identified as a 13-year-old girl. She followed a few easily identifiable accounts on weight loss, dieting, eating disorders, and she was deluged, literally, within a day of content pushed to her by algorithms that, in effect, promoted self-injury and eating disorders. Are you surprised by that fact?
I'm not surprised by that fact. Facebook has internal research where they have done even more gentle versions of that experiment, where they have started from things like interest in healthy recipes, so not even extreme dieting. And because of the nature of engagement-based ranking and amplification of interests, That imaginary user was pushed, or that real account was pushed towards extreme dieting and pro-anorexia content very rapidly.
And that's the algorithm.
That's the algorithm.
That algorithm could be changed.
The algorithm definitely could be changed. I have firsthand experience from having worked at Pinterest. Pinterest used to be an application that was heavily based just on you follow certain people's pins, and those are put into your feed. And over time, it grew to be much, much more heavily based on recommendations, that the algorithm would figure out what are you interested in. You can have wonderful experiences that are based on human interactions, So these are human scale technologies, not computers choosing what we focus on.
So the average parent listening here worried about their daughter or son being deluged with these kinds of content would want that kind of algorithm changed, I would think, and would welcome the oversight that you're recommending.
I believe parents deserve more options and more choices, and today they don't know even what they could be asking for.
I just received by text, literally about 15 minutes ago, a message from someone in Connecticut, and I'm going to read it to you. It's from a dad. I'm in tears right now watching your interaction with Frances Haugen. My 15-year-old daughter loved her body at 14, was on Instagram constantly, and maybe posting too much. Suddenly she started hating her body dysmorphia, now anorexia, and was in deep, deep trouble before we found treatment. I fear she'll never be the same. I'm brokenhearted. I think people tend to lose sight of the real world impact here. And I think that's the reason that you're here. I'd just like to invite you, if you have any words to those other employees at big tech, the workers who may be troubled by the misconduct or unethical conduct that they see, what you would tell them.
We live in a pattern that we have seen throughout time with regard to technologies, is that humans are very crafty people. Like we find interesting solutions, but we often get out over our skis, right? We develop things that are of a larger scale than we really know how to handle. And what we have done in the past is when we see this happen, we take a step back and we find institutions and we find frameworks for doing these things in a safe way. We live in a moment where whistleblowers are very important because these technological systems are walled off. They are very complicated. They're things that you need to be a specialist to really understand the consequences of. And the fact that we've been having the exact same kinds of false choice discussions about what to do about Facebook, you know, is it about privacy or oversight? Is it about censorship or safety? Like the fact that we're being asked these false choices is just an illustration of what happens when the real solutions are hidden inside of companies. We need more tech employees to come forward through legitimate channels like the SEC or Congress. To make sure that the public has the information they need in order to have technologies be human-centric, not computer-centric.
And that was former Facebook manager, whistleblower Frances Haugen speaking before the Senate committee. Efforts to pass new regulations on social media have failed in the past. But on Tuesday, senators said that new revelations about Facebook show the time for inaction has passed. However, let it not be misunderstood that the largest lobbyists in Washington, D.C. is Alphabet, which, as you know, owns Google, and Facebook isn't far behind. So to rely on Congress to complete that regulation, how are you going to do it? It's suggested that it's going to be long-term process, multi-generational, and require a lot of self-organization on non-commercial web to try and affect any kind of change. The other thing to remember is that Mark Zuckerberg owns 51% of the company, which puts him in ultimate control. It's not a hierarchy. He has the ultimate say on what happens on his in his private company. This is WBAI's New York. I'm Rebecca Miles, and you're listening to What's Going On. We'll just take a musical break now. And welcome back to WBAI 99.5 FM. You're listening to What's Going On. I'm the host, Rebecca Miles. I just felt like a need for something calm after all that testimony from the Senate committee, from the whistleblower from Facebook. That was a track from Darfur Yousef, a track called Humankind. I was first introduced to it last week by a guest I had on a show, Alexandria Tanos. I found that a wonderful piece and I keep listening to it. We're just lining up our guests for the second half of the show. If you would like to make calls to the show, the number to call is 212-209-2877. And we'll have a music break at 7:40 just to see if we can take some calls at that time off. We've heard from our guest today, who is Dr. Eric North. He's an assistant professor of urban and community forests at the University of Minnesota. Welcome to the show, Eric North.
Hi, thank you for having me.
No, I'm delighted. At the top of the show, I was explaining to listeners that this very interesting study has come out, The Pitfalls of Tree Planting, Show Why We Need People-Centered Natural Climate Solutions. And it's just been come out in Bioscience, really ahead of COP26, which is this gathering in Glasgow, Scotland this year, where world leaders and their representatives get to discuss the Paris Agreement, the general UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. And often what one of the programs we hear about regularly is the planting of trees will solve climate crisis. So I wanted to get your take on that argument, particularly in light of this study that's just come out, and what are the misconceptions and what are the benefits of a program to, for instance, plant a trillion trees? What would that look like, and what would likely be the outcome?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. First, let's look at the planting an enormous amount of trees, whether it's a million or a trillion, even thousands, you know, if you're a small community. So I work with urban forests and people that are living in cities where our green vegetation is very important to making these livable places, really, for us, both from an aesthetic or a personal view, from our mental and physical health, but also just from the various things they help with in terms of making the environment less harsh, to mitigating stormwater, and just really making our environment much better. One of the things that we've noticed from research is that planting an enormous amount of trees, while it seems intuitively like this would be really helpful, what we've noticed is that if you don't also then have some system in place to maintain or make sure that all of those million, trillion, thousands of trees, whatever it is, actually live for decades and potentially centuries, depending upon their placement, they do less help than simply maintaining old trees that are already in place. There was just a study that came out of Helsinki that looked at newly planted trees. Now it's limited to the number of species they looked at, but in terms of their ability to sequester carbon, especially after construction in urban areas, it takes about 14 or so years before those trees really start having a positive impact on taking carbon out of the atmosphere. Before that, there's a bunch of carbon that's lost from soils, from the disturbing of the ground and things of that nature, so that the soils are actually respirating carbon back into the atmosphere. If you have a system that's been in place and undisturbed for a long period of time, that carbon that's in the soil, which we often forget about, stays in the soil, or more of it stays in the soil. And as trees grow, they're absorbing carbon, and little trees absorb carbon very quickly, but they don't absorb a lot, you know, just like any little organism. You know, infants eat a lot, they eat regularly, human infants, but they're not eating as much as a full-grown adult, right? And so full-grown trees that are there for a long period of time and are maintained absorb an enormous amount of carbon, and they keep it, and really keeping that carbon out of the atmosphere for a long period of time is part of the solution.
So what's the better way of doing that? If there, if so that you're up against, people are wanting a solution to this because we're all being, there's increased flooding, the hurricanes are fiercer, there's fires breaking out in forests up and down the West Coast. People are looking for solutions. If this is one that you have to be a bit more temperate in your enthusiasm for, what are some better ways of doing it?
Well, I think one of the issues that we're having is people are looking for a solution as opposed to a suite of solutions. Mm. And trees are part of your toolkit in terms of a solution toward climate change. And we can't stop it at this point, but what we can do is slow it or reduce the negative impacts. And trees, you have to remember, if you're planting a tree today, it's really taking out future carbon out of the atmosphere. You know, you're not doing a lot for carbon the day you plant the tree. Like I just said, some of the research has, you know, takes trees 15 or so years before they're really having a positive impact on drawing carbon out. So solution are things like reducing the amount of carbon we're putting into the atmosphere, which is not really a plant solution. That's a, we have to, you know, think about the fuels that we're using. We have to think about the transportation primarily that we're using. Our food production, all of these types of things need to go in combination with. And protecting habitats, you know, I'm an urban forester, so I work primarily within the confines of a city and looking at trees that are planted in our maintained parks and streets. But if you're in a in an area that has natural forests or wetlands around your city, around wherever you're living, maintaining those and making sure that they're managed properly is really key to making sure that we continue to have livable spaces and to help mitigate some of the impacts of these more disastrous storms. Any solution will take likely decades, if not centuries, before we really see a massive change in how the climate is responding. The climate is just such a, you know, our atmosphere is just such an enormous thing that making changes takes time.
Right. I mean, it's a big issue. I mean, I don't think there's any short and fast answer. I'm living in part of the city, the Lower East Side, where there's a city park. There are trees there that have been there for 70 years. The city proposal, because this area got flooded during Hurricane Sandy, is to tear up the park, bring in landfill and build a kind of wall, or really a hill of 10 feet or 8 to 10 feet, and then plant turf, astroturf on top with new saplings. So the work will probably take 3 to 4 years. So in that time, there'll be no protection for this area, if that was the intention. And then the tree saplings will, take another 10 years, 8 years to grow. AstroTurf is really not the best material for people or plant life or animal life. So I'm just curious about that whole project and whether the idea of tearing up a park to make way for another park makes any sense at all.
Well, without having seen the park, you know, it's hard to give an exact answer, but I would say in general, if you have a green space that is functioning, meaning that it's not dangerous, you know, sometimes trees do get to an age where when it's trees and people combined, the safe thing to do is remove them, assuming that's not the case and that these trees are in good enough condition and health and are growing. 70 years old, depending on the tree species, could just be its infancy or at least its adolescence. Mm. You know, if we're looking at things like oaks that might live to be 250, 300 years old, other species around that clearly can go into that century plus mark, you know, you've got a good long while to keep those trees on in play and helping with with anything, really, climate change and stormwater and all of that. Now, if part of the reason to put the berm in that you described is to help with flooding or things like that, you know, maybe there's a way to do that and also keep the trees. Whenever I work with people that are doing construction on parks or anywhere around trees, we try to see how much we can reasonably retain to meet the objectives of the project that's underway, as well as keeping mature trees. There's a what we talk about in the urban forestry and the tree world is, you know, it's common for people to say, we're going to remove these trees and we're going to replace them with new trees. Mm-hmm. Well, I would like people to think you can't replace a 70-year-old tree. Mm-hmm. What you can do is plant a new tree, but you can't replace it. It took 70 years for it to do what it's doing. And even putting in a new tree, it'll take 70 years, which means you've lost another 70 years of this mature growth and sequestering of carbon. In projects where trees, mature trees, need to be removed, one of the things that can happen, and I think that should happen more, is taking a look at, don't just remove those trees that were standing there. And a lot of times when trees are removed, they're burned, they're buried in pits, like a tree landfill, or they're chipped up into mulch and spread around. That's okay. You know, what we prefer to see are those trees taken off and turned into products that have a longer life. So think about trees in a traditional forest. When you cut them down and you make building materials out of them, 2x4s and things like that, now that carbon that was sequestered from kind of a climate change perspective is locked into whatever material you just made. If you've built a house, you know, I'm in a house that's 100+ years old. And so thinking, well, the timbers that are in here have been continuing to keep that sequestered carbon stored and locked away in the house. And so making sure if we do remove trees, if we can find what I like to think of as the best use first, which means how can you utilize that wood product, that carbon that's been stored, and keep it locked in for a long period of time.
Mm. Well, the trees in the area, I mean, obviously I'm asking you about something you haven't looked at, but they're oaks, they're plane trees, and they're linden trees. I know linden can be a little fragile, but there's, you know, extensive families and, you know, brothers and sisters. You can see the relatives all lined up around each other. I wanted to ask you about something that came up in this study that was just published published actually last year in Bioscience. But there was an argument that perhaps instead of actually, I'll just hold there because I think we're going to go for a musical break and see if there are any listeners who have any questions for you about urban forestry. If we just go for a quick musical break, and the number to call, well, listeners know the number to call, but if you could just reach out to us if you have any questions for my guest, Dr. Eric North.
Thank you.
And welcome back to What's Going On This Morning. I'm the host, Rebecca Miles. You're listening to 99.5 FM in New York City. On the show with me today is Dr. Eric North, Assistant Professor of Urban and Community Forests from the City of Minnesota, from the University of Minnesota. We've just been talking about urban forestry, some of these campaigns that we hear about, certainly in New York City. The Mayor Bloomberg had a campaign to build, to plant a million trees. I understand that he did actually end up planting 155,000 sidewalk trees and 750,000 trees in city parks. I do know one of the consequences of that is that certainly allergies, allergy rates went up in the city. There is something about living in a place where there's skyscrapers, the air gets trapped between buildings, then you have air conditioning heat and it all swirls around and it can be quite unpleasant, certainly in the spring and fall. Excuse me. I did hear that, and perhaps Eric could enlighten me on this, that this can happen if you plant more male trees than female trees. Is there any truth to that?
Yes. Excuse me. Yes, absolutely. Trees are really interesting in terms of their reproduction. You have trees that, species of tree that have male and female reproductive parts on the same tree. Excuse me. And you have trees that are either male or they're female. So for instance, just to give you an example, there's a tree called Kentucky Coffee Tree, and there is a male tree and a female tree. The male trees are often favored because they do not produce fruit. So only the female trees will produce the whatever the seed is for that tree. If a Kentucky Coffee Tree, it's a pretty sizable pod. If it's apples, you'd have apples or things like that that could potentially fall on sidewalks. And so that's something, you know, most municipalities want to avoid, so they tend to favor planting male trees. The consequence of planting all male trees of any particular species or a bias towards male trees is that you get an increase in pollen. And so that's a very real thing that can happen in urban forests in particular. We're trying to solve one problem and we've created potentially a second problem.
Because the females are there, not the female trees are not around to absorb the pollen.
Not only not absorb them, but it's just that, you know, if you have 100 trees and you were to let it go to kind of chance and you had 50-50, you'd have 50% less pollen if it was 50% males and 50% females. And so it, probably less that the females are there to absorb it, and just there's less that's actually in the atmosphere. There are also tree species that trees are pollinated in different ways. So our ash trees, our native ash trees, which have been under attack by an invasive pest, emerald ash borer, all of those trees are primarily wind pollinated, which means the pollen is light. And as soon as wind touches a male tree, the pollen is blown. And that's what gets in the atmosphere. Trees that are pollinated by insects, many of our basswoods, have a stickier pollen so that as bees or other insects go into the flower, the pollen sticks to them. If it was airborne, it'd be really hard for the bee to transport it from one tree to another. So if we looked at using only male trees from species that were insect pollinated and had this stickier pollen, allergies would likely not increase noticeably. It's really an increase in these wind pollinated male varieties.
I believe we have one caller. Caller, you're on the air. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Yes. Good morning. This is Diane from the Bronx. I'd like to say I appreciate the discussion of trees. I'm encouraged that the additional information, particularly what you're talking about right now about the female and the male, I've never heard that. So I'm hoping maybe that'll give the Parks Department new information, and they'll help the host there have the future without so much pollen. But I had two questions. One, full-grown trees. I'm in the Northwest Bronx, and full-grown trees, many of them now The bark is just falling off the trees. You know, he's full grown, and that seems to be, I don't know what is going on. Is that a beetle? Is that something? And then the second issue is that there seems to be a fungus, and it looks kind of like a pale grayish, greenish, and that seems to be attacking a lot of trees as well, and full-grown ones. So could you speak on that?
Thank you. Eric, why would the bark be falling? This is not plane trees that the bark's falling off, because that does happen, doesn't it?
Yes. So I was going to say there's a lot of plane trees or sycamores that I know grow on the east in New York. And so once those trees get to a certain size, it's just a natural part of the tree. They shed part of its outer layer of bark. If that's happening to, say, an oak, which would be uncommon, that typically means that in that space, maybe the oak is reaching the end of its life. And it's shedding bark because parts of the tree are starting to die. And if that's the case, the tree should be inspected and then likely removed. It's not uncommon in our urban trees, particularly the trees that are planted between, you know, the sidewalk and the curb, or right in the sidewalk along our streets, that those trees, just because of the limited space they have to grow in, and it's a difficult space, just don't live as long. And we know that as urban foresters. We might think of those trees kind of maximum life, you know, somewhere in that 30 to 50 year range is not uncommon. And once the tree starts to sort of fall apart like that, removal is what needs to happen. And then you can plant a new tree. The fungus, it's hard to say. There's the fungal world is has a lot of variety into it, and understanding exactly what you're looking at can be difficult. The patches, this sort of green-gray patches, that could be something called lichen, which is actually a combination of fungus and algae that can get on trees, and it's usually on the wetter side, so it's not uncommon to find it on like a northeast side of a tree. And it does not hurt the tree at all. It can look alarming if you're not sure what you're looking at, but it's not a problem for the tree. If it's actual fungus where we see like mushrooms growing out of it, that's something that should be reported to who's ever doing the tree inspection in your area to make sure that they take a look at it so that the tree can either be removed or that particular diseased part can be cut out.
Mm. I believe we have another caller. Thank you to the caller from the Bronx. I'm sorry I didn't catch your name, but appreciate those two questions about the fungus and the peeling bark. I hope it's just a plane tree and going through the motions of its season, and the fungus is not too worrisome. But I believe we have one more caller. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi, my name is Dwayne, and I'm calling from Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn.
Hi, Dwayne. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about species selection and some of the habitat provisions that the trees may play for other species in the city, particularly birds or other insects that might be beneficial to ecosystem health in cities.
Yeah, that's a great question. Tree selection is always on the mind, I feel, of urban foresters, in particular, probably in the last few decades, where we're being much more cautious about how we select trees. There can be trees that we look at there, where they grow in nature gives us a good understanding of how they might perform in a city and what other species they might support. So, you mentioned birds and insects. Unfortunately, there's not a single resource that I'm aware of that pairs. Here are the animals and here are the trees and here's how they pair up together. Here are the insects and here are the trees. So we often have to look at multiple sources. The big challenge in urban forests is that even though we might want to support some of our native trees or native animal species, our urban areas are not usually very closely related to the native environment that those, you know, in New York, for instance, New York City is clearly not anything like the natural landscape that New York City is surrounded by. And so we often end up picking trees that will survive well in a city, and hopefully they also can support some wildlife. Now, when you're talking about planting trees in a park, you have a much greater ability to try to pair these broader ecosystem services and support wildlife. Doing so typically means planting a wider range of tree species that are native, at least to North America, as those tend to support our native insects and our native wildlife much better than some of our non-native and non-native to North America typically.
Great. Duane, do you have another question for our guest?
It was just kind of a little bit of a follow-up. Does that, you know, would that, you know, end up in sort of creating a little bit of a biological desert in cities if we're just planting tree species to sort of bend towards the urban and human environment when urban areas are taking up so much of the human land mass these days, and sort of the relationship that starts to build with, you know, nature in cities and urban ecology?
Yeah, you definitely will get, I don't know that I would say a desert. Even some of our non-native trees still support, there are insects that kind of don't care what plant they're on. They just go to any plant with nectar and flowers. And then there are insects that have very specific plants they need. And so we have both, and so that's good. So you can create a little bit. There's a little bit of a misunderstanding. Most of our land, at least in North America, is not cities. They actually take up by land area a smaller amount than, say, agriculture or some of our other natural areas. So there's a lot that goes into supporting a city. But a city itself, land area-wise, is, you know, it seems like they're huge, but really when you get into the expanses through the rest of the country, it's a smaller percent. I think that what you're hitting on there is the real importance for maintaining parks. And I will tell you that a young, newly planted park with new species and new trees, whatever they are, does not support as much wildlife as a mature park with mature trees and mature vegetation at all levels. So ground level, this kind of mid, you know, 5 to 10 foot level, and then the big trees that are towering over everything. So we know from ecology that maintaining trees and natural spaces of varying ages is extremely important for supporting wildlife.
And we're going to have to leave it there. I'm really sorry, guys. Dr. Eric North, Assistant Professor of Urban and Community Forests. Check him out. He's at the University of Minnesota. And that team he's part of is really interesting, worth a check out. Certainly this essay in Bioscience written by Forrest Fleischman. He had a really interesting Twitter feed, which started this whole exploration. Thank you very much for listening this morning. This is What's Going On. I'm host Rebecca Miles. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM. Eric, thank you very much for your time this morning. I know it's very early for you. And thank you to the engineer, Michael Haskins, and to the help from Linda Perry, the program manager. Good morning.
And now, our local station board candidate statements.
This is WBAI New York. The election for the local station board is currently underway with 27 listener candidates.
My name is Rachel Barr, and I'm running for the LSB as a listener candidate. I've been a member of BAI for 40 years and a listener for 46 years. I was a volunteer for 5 years and was a producer. I work well with others, be they co-LSB members or management, because of my professional and political life is all about collaboration. Though there might be differences of opinion, when we work together, we can do what needs to be done. Thank you for your time. See you in the streets.
My name is Scotty Battle. This is my first time running for the local station board of my beloved WBAI. In the 20 years I have been a listener and financial supporter, I'm an enthusiastic 20-year public school teacher and creative thinker with a deep love for the preservation of WBAI. I aim to protect WBAI from being sold off by contributing to peaceful debate and collaboration as I strongly advocate for innovative changes which adhere to the Pacifica mission to nurture and grow listenership through development across multimedia platforms.
I'm John Brinkley with the Justice and Unity Campaign. I voted no in the bylaws referendum because I believe in member democracy. I want a strong station with all board members kept informed about station projects and all staff treated fairly and respectfully. This year, my work with the People's Organization for Progress made possible the placement of a cost-free WBAI billboard on the New Jersey Turnpike. Our station has too much to offer to remain anyone's secret.
My name is Stephanie Byers, and I'm very happy to speak to you. WBAI has been a beacon of independent thinking and reporting, a forum of unpopular views and voices, and a place to debate ideas. When I feel down about the state of the world, I turn on WBAI, and inevitably there is a voice of reason with fresh ideas and perspectives. This gives me hope. I want to donate my time, money, and efforts to continue this amazing 60-plus years of honest, open, trustworthy, independent radio.
Priscilla Kankar is a recent graduate of the Teachers College at Columbia University. She recently brought her expertise in social media, website development, and organizing voter data to a local city council campaign as digital director. Priscilla says she's aware of the serious impact of privatization of public and community resources. She hopes to bring community-oriented, uncensored,